If it please the court, I am Clara L. Larry, and I represent the appellant Glenn E. Jones. This is an appeal of the grant of summary judgment in the lower court. The first issue that the court is asked to address is whether the granting of summary judgment, sui sponte, without notice to Jones, was erroneous. And the plaintiff filed a motion for summary judgment. In response to his motion for summary judgment, the defendant filed a document styled Defendant's Memorandum in Opposition to the Plaintiff's Motion for Summary Judgment. In the body of that caption, the beginning and the ending, the defendant asked the court to deny the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment and grant summary judgment in favor of the defendant.
Ms. Larry, can you identify any evidence that you did not present in your summary judgment motion or any arguments that you had not made, that you would have made to the district court had the proper notice been provided?
I think if the plaintiff had known that he was actually responding to a motion for summary judgment as opposed to filing a reply brief, then he would have submitted some additional affidavits which basically would have countered some of the arguments that the court made in response to the plaintiff's discriminatory work assignment claim. For example, in that claim, the defendant only raised one issue, and that issue was that the discriminatory work assignment claim should, the summary judgment should be denied because the discriminatory work assignment claim was not included in the plaintiff's EEOC charge. In response to that, the plaintiff presented the argument that it was a 1981 claim, and as a 1981 claim, it was not required to be an administrative filing. That was the only argument that was raised in the response. Had we known that the court was going to consider a motion for summary judgment, and we would have presented some additional affidavits on the discriminatory work assignment, how other African Americans had been denied the opportunity to work on doors inside of the cars, and how they'd also been denied training to learn the skills to work on doors. We would have brought in some additional witnesses based on those allegations. With respect to the discriminatory discharge claim, we would have brought in some additional affidavits which would have shown that none of the employees knew that the defendant considered security officers to be supervisors within the meaning of this disciplinary policy. There was nothing written in the policy that says that security officers are elevated to supervisors. And determining whether or not a level 5 offense have occurred. Had we known the court was going to consider the defendant's response to summary judgment, we would have brought in some additional affidavits on that respect. There are other matters that we would have addressed had we known, as I stated, that we were filing, that it was not a reply, but a response to a motion for summary judgment.
Thank you.
It's clear based on the reading of the district court that it did not believe it was presented with a motion for summary judgment. In its judgment order, the court stated that it was ordering that the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment is denied and the defendant's request is granted. Established precedent in this circuit and in other circuits have refused to consider uncaptioned requests in the body of a pleading or memorandum as a motion. And the reason is that such uncaptioned requests do not conform to the requirements of Rule 7B1. And that rule provides that an application for an order must be in writing and must be by motion. And the reason behind the rule is that the motion gives the parties notice. And it also gives the court notice so that the parties can provide an appropriate response. In the instant case, Jones had no notice, explicit or otherwise, that the court was considering the defendant's response as a motion for summary judgment until it received the defendant's responsive brief. Jones is not contending that under no circumstances can a district court grant a motion for summary judgment sui sponte. We believe that that power is inherited in Rule 56. However, even Rule 56 has a notice provision. And the plaintiff, a party who moves for summary judgment, does not waive his right to notice. If the district court decides that it wants to test the strength of the movement's case against the summary judgment stage, in this instance case, Jones was entitled to notice, and by filing a motion for summary judgment, he was not waiving his right to trial if the district court believed that he had not met his burden under Rule 56. The next issue before the court is whether there's a material issue of fact as to whether Jones violated Union Pacific Railroad Company's disciplinary policy by allegedly engaging in misconduct after work and away from his work site. The pro-offered reason for Jones' discharge is insubordination and quarrelsome, and the incident occurred on April 28 at 4:30 p.m. after Jones' shift had ended and after Jones had left his workstation and when he was approximately, I believe he stated, 3 rails from the public highway. In fact, most of the incident that in which he is charged with occurred on a public street. By Union Pacific Railroad's definition, insubordination is a refusal to carry out the clear instructions of a supervisor or when there is gross disrespect for a supervisor. By its definition, quarrelsome is when an employee's continued behavior is inclined or disposed towards an angry confrontation in the workplace. The guidelines do not state that a police officer or a security guard or a union police officer is elevated to a supervisor for purposes of determining when one of the level 5 offenses occurred. The policy does state that it is not all inclusive or absolute, but it is intended to serve as a guide to determine whether or not the offense had occurred. Because it did, because of that statement, the plaintiff served a Rule 30B6 notice of deposition. That notice specifically asked Union Pacific Railroad Company to produce a witness who could answer questions concerning the disciplinary policy. The railroad company produced Rick Lowe as a 30B6 witness. At his deposition, I read the guidelines for determining insubordination, and he agreed they were correct. I read the definitions for determining whether quarrelsome had occurred. He agreed that it was correct. I then asked him whether or not there were any other guidelines for determining when an employee had committed a level 5 offense, and he stated, not to my knowledge. Jones testified that Brody was not his supervisor, and the inference to be raised from the 30B6 witnesses, Brody was not a supervisor. I will also note for the court that on the incident that occurred on April 28, Jones was walking across the railroad track, which he had gone throughout his entire tenure with the railroad company. Over the period of time, he had been stopped at least 30 times. Each time that he'd been stopped, he would simply raise his ID and say, I'm a railroad employee, and he'd proceed along his way. On this particular day, there had never been any disciplinary actions against him, not in the 10 years prior to this incident. In fact, he had received letters of commendation for perfect attendance. He had received commendations for abiding by the court, by his employer's health and safety standards, and his record had no disciplinary action in it. However, in order to avert the inference to be raised from that 30B6 witness who stated that there were no other guidelines which would for determining when the level 5 offense occurred, the Union Pacific Railroad Company presented an affidavit of Rickenstein, an affidavit which contrasted and conflicted with the affidavit of the 30B6 witness. In the reply brief, Jones contested that affidavit as being precluded by Rule 30B6. However, it was based on Rule 30B6 Rickenstein's affidavit that the court concluded that and the definition that the court gathered from Black's Law Dictionary that Brody was in fact his supervisor. And we believe that that amounted to speculation and credibility determination. And those are factors that are not to be considered on summary judgment. I think I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larry. Mr. LaFave?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Dan LaFave, and I represent the Union Pacific Railroad in this case. Ms. Larry has raised a number of issues by her appeal. The first one, of course, is whether or not this Court could properly grant summary judgment where the plaintiff had filed a motion for summary judgment, and the defendant in its response pointed out to the district court that the plaintiff was not entitled to summary judgment under the law because she had failed to prove a prima facie case, and because the facts and evidence that were of record before the court showed that there was no evidence of pretext. And based upon the law and the facts and the evidence, the defendant's response suggested to the district court that therefore under the law that the defendant in fact was entitled to summary judgment in its favor as opposed to the plaintiff.
You know, according to Brody's own statement, he stopped Jones because he fit the description of those who trespassed. Namely, he was a black male, and he was wearing soiled clothing. Isn't that the type of racial profiling that can be considered evidence of discriminatory animus?
I don't believe so at all, Your Honor, and let me explain why. Rickardson, in his affidavit, which was admitted in the plaintiff's response, indicate that the surrounding neighborhood is virtually entirely African-American community. This is a rail yard, and adjoining it is a city auto impound. And both Officer Brody and his supervisor, Officer Finger, indicated that there had been ongoing problems with trespass through the rail yard, theft from the railroad property, and that some of these people used the railroad property as access, back access to the auto impound to steal materials from the auto lot, from the city impound. And therefore, when people are seen crossing the lot, they are stopped and challenged if they're not recognized by the special agent. Mr. Jones admitted during his deposition that he had never seen Officer Brody before. Officer Brody, who was a relatively new officer, he'd only been with the department for, I believe, 9 months, having come from the Indiana State Police, didn't know Mr. Jones at all, had not previously encountered Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones did not leave at 4:30 when the shift ended like just about every other employee does. Instead, he went to his locker room, which he's entitled to do, and he was leaving 40 minutes later by a route that Officer Finger described as one that employees don't normally take across the yard. Therefore, under the circumstances, there's no basis to decide that it was the color of his skin as opposed to his apparent illegal trespass. As we pointed out in our brief, Illinois law prohibits anyone from being on railroad property with certain exceptions. One of those exceptions is a railroad employee. But until Mr. Jones or any other person who was encountered in the railroad yard after hours, who didn't appear to have a reason to be there, provided satisfactory proof that he was a railroad employee, then there was cause to arrest. And it wasn't the color of his skin, it was his activity and his presence in the yard. And I think that distinguishes the matter.
If we consider the evidence in the light most favorable to Jones, which we have to do here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you saying that we can't say that Brody initiated the stop in part because of Jones's race?
There's absolutely.
He then calls in his supervisor and escalates the matter based on his fears that the neighbors, who were apparently African Americans, were going to take his side and come against him.
Your Honor,
we can just say that as a matter of law, race has played no role in Brody's decision to question Jones.
There's no evidence that it played any. There's nothing other than the color of Jones's skin that says he was stopped because he was black. as opposed to he was stopped because he appeared to be trespassing in a rail yard carrying a bag that could be used to conceal items that maybe have been stolen either from the railroad or from the auto impound.
Well, what actions taken by Jones elicited suspicion as he comes walking?
Your Honor, he's not walking on a public street.
No, I understand.
He's walking on railroad property, private railroad property, where he is illegally present unless he's and until he satisfactorily shows that he's an employee who has business being there. There's no further stop or reason for
a stop. Was there an attempt by Jones, for instance, to evade notice?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand the evade notice.
Yeah.
Oh, to conceal himself?
Sure.
No, apparently not, Your Honor. But the other factor is...
Did Brody ever argue that he suspected that Mr. Jones was a trespasser because employees shouldn't be in that area? Did I miss something?
Not because employees shouldn't be in the area, although it was an unusual area for employees to be. Mr. Jones described himself as having crossed something like 14 tracks in the yard, another 9 tracks, and then he was on one of the 3 main tracks used by the commuter lines where he was encountered by Officer Brody.
Didn't he base his suspicion solely on Jones's physical appearance?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
All right, what else?
His presence in the rail yard. After hours, at a time where employees are not normally seen, and after employees have normally long since departed the area. And that was explained at the disciplinary hearing that was conducted afterwards prior to Mr. Jones's termination. He testified to exactly those facts, that I suspected it was trespass.
And just seeing him, does that give Brody reasonable suspicion that Jones is involved in some criminal activity?
It gives him the right to determine whether or not he has any business being on the railroad property, and if he doesn't, to escort him off. This isn't a case where he, without any further information, made a decision to arrest, Your Honor. What he did was he found somebody on the property that apparently had no business being there, and attempted to determine whether or not he did have a right to be there. And once that information is provided, then everybody can go on their way.
Your position is he would have stopped anybody, or everybody?
Anyone. There's no evidence that any non-minorities were seen trespassing in that area. There's no evidence that was developed. Instead, the evidence showed that there had been 59 individuals stopped in the prior, I don't remember when it was, 2 or 3 years that we provided records for, in 38 different instances, that 2 of those were black females, 3 were Hispanic males, and everyone else was a black male. There's no record that any Caucasians or other non-minorities were not stopped, were seen there and not stopped. And the records were of stops as well as persons that were arrested. There was, they weren't just of people that were stopped and then let go, and no record was made of that. The records, in fact, were of everyone that
when
was
I stopped. Recall your opponent saying that the plaintiff in this case had been stopped many times before, and had shown his identification and gone his way rejoicing?
Apparently by other officers, not by
Officer but he had been stopped before, so the idea of being stopped in that spot and having to show his identification was nothing new to him.
No, it wasn't, Your Honor. He may have been tired of that procedure. He may have felt that this was improper, and that may have been the reason for the reaction as testified to by Officer Brody. And in fact, it was an extreme reaction. The other thing, Your Honor, I think we should also point out that Officer Brody did not make the final decision in this case. He was not a decision maker. And even if there was some animus, I don't believe that it should taint the decision maker's decision, who reviewed the transcript of the investigation that was held, at which Mr. Jones was represented by union attorney or union representatives, had a chance to cross-examine witnesses, to put on some evidence if they desired to, and the superintendent of the commuter operations and the director of mechanical reviewed the transcript and made a decision based upon their honest good faith belief as far as did these acts as described by Officer Brody and by Officer Finger constitute insubordination and quarrelsomeness under the Union Pacific rules.
Does it seem at least bit odd to you that Mr. Brody claimed to be afraid of Mr. Jones because Mr. Jones was calling to people on neighboring porches, even though he testified that what Mr. Jones was telling the people on the porches was to call the police?
Well,
is that the way?
Mr. Jones at the investigation hearing didn't testify to just that. Mr. Jones himself at the investigation hearing testified that I was telling the people to call the police, this white racist hillbilly is harassing me. And according to Officer Brody's, if you'll excuse my language, but of course according to Officer Brody's description, it was the white racist hillbilly mother with a gun. And that was repeated on a number of occasions, and a crowd began to gather. Frankly, I think any officer, white or black, would have been concerned with his safety at that point in time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Larry. Okay. Ms. Larry, your time has expired, but you may have a minute for rebuttal if you wish.
I just wanted to make two comments. One is that the counsel stated that Officer Brody did not make the decision to terminate Mr. Jones, and that is true. However, Brody provided the information in which the defendant relied on to terminate Mr. Jones. The second point that I want to raise is at his disciplinary hearing, Mr. Jones was not represented by an attorney. He was represented by a union rep who was an employee like Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Ms. Larry. Thank you, Ms. Lefebvre. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the sixth case of the day of the United States versus Ebert.